Diversity Music Group. Alex H.
Alex H.
The Bomb Factory.
Success.
Ladies and gentlemen, allow me to properly introduce the most incredible beast from the east, live and live in color, in shape fitted to leather and soft butter. Color up, my dollars up, I'm winning exotic cars and women, women and more women. More sin and I'm addicted to success. Blessed, young and gifted, the bar's been lifting. Started from the bottom, I'm now on top of the world. Look, ma, I made it, the new most hated. Underestimated since I haven't been painting. Our stories aren't related, so they don't believe. But who cares, I'ma run a few years before I fade to black. My impact shift back to order to lyrical manslaughter in the first degree.
And we welcome you to the latest edition of the Green and White Show here on this Sunday, January 10th, 2016. Thank you so much for tuning in, starting your day here on the Green and White Show, of course, with your boys, Joseph Haas and Amiri Tello. Haas, my man, how are you?
I'm still trying to wrap my brain around the beginning of the NFL postseason. We finally made it here. You know what, Amiri, the Fitzmagical season of the New York Jets ended last week. We're going to get into that a little bit more. Hey, you know, that guy out in the Golden State, that's right, Steph Curry, he's out there cooking. I mean, Curry with the shot. Not so hot, the Cincinnati Bengals. What? I just can't wait to get into that. We've got so much to talk about here. We're going to congratulate players like Nick Mangold for making another Pro Bowl. We know we really wanted to see them play this past weekend, and after seeing what happened in the AFC games, man, I know Jets fans are just, so why am I still talking? Let's get into it, man. You ready to talk some Jets football or what?
Indeed. And well, as you just mentioned there, Jets season comes to a close. Tough way to end, you know, the season. You know, the game against the Buffalo Bills, 22-17. You know, you lose on the road. You lose, in front of Rex Ryan. So it's definitely a tough way to end a season that was really, for the most part, that when you look back at it, it had so many promising moments, specifically that last, you know, five-game rampage at the end of the season. The game was the game. I mean, the game was a mistake-prone game by the Jets, and I don't think they were the better team, obviously. And when you talk about just the way in which they lost, the fact that they really didn't do anything to deserve, to close it out at the end with the way that they were, making, mistakes just piled upon each other offensively and defensively. You know, it's just one of those games where you just look back and you just wish they could have done more. They definitely could have done more, and that more did not happen. And that's why we're here today with, the Jets not in the wild card conversation, at least.
Ryan Fitzpatrick only mustering 181 passing yards, 2 touchdowns, but 3 interceptions, including a very costly one, an attempt to Eric Decker in the end zone. As we all know, the first red zone interception of the season for Ryan Fitzpatrick, and one that we all could tell that he felt very bad about, and Decker wish he did more. How much more can these two players do? Brandon Marshall and Eric Decker, 13 receptions in the game, 176 yards. They played their heart out, but think about that for a second. Fitzmagic gets 181 yards passing, 176 to those guys. So including the drop by Tompkins, which could have been the game winner. There were a lot of balls left out on the table, and Nunwa with the 5-yard reception. You had to see more Jets making a move. And I know you can remember me talking about this, pretty much throughout the entire season. Yeah, it's a 3-phase football game, and one of the phases that I thought that the Jets weren't taking advantage of, Amiri, is the special teams phase. And we all know they've made a change there, letting go of their special teams coach. So the Jets already making moves. One move I think they should have made mid-game, and one that even Rex Ryan talked about during the game and afterwards, with the coverage Darrelle Revis had on Watkins, and that was you could tell the cushion was a little too much there, and they tore up the New York Jets right there, and they said beat them there, and that's where the Buffalo Bills really beat them, Amiri.
Right, right. And, you know, I want to go back to the point you made earlier about Ryan Fitzpatrick, just mm-hmm. not his game. That's it was just not his game. You know, the three interceptions obviously did not help. And,
biggest
you know,
game of
you
talk
about the I would say so. I would say so. And it's equally disappointing, again, because he just came off of that five-game rampage where he did look like, and he, mm-hmm. you know, he came down the stretch, made those fourth-quarter, you know, comebacks, made those fourth-quarter two-minute drives. He made the plays that the Jets needed to win consistently, and like, that, those expectations were really, like, leveled, like, completely with the way that he played against the Buffalo Bills, you know, last week, week 17. But, you know, just not enough. And Ryan Fitzpatrick, you know, had an opportunity in this game to really cement what the Jets season and what his personal season was, right? Like, if he was able to take the Jets, imagine the storyline, right? If he was able to take the Jets from, you know, a team bordering, you know, the postseason conversation to six straight wins and in the playoffs, then the Jets would have had that huge, you know, expanse of confidence with, you know, the way that their quarterback was playing, with the way that, you know, the team in general was playing.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
they would
have
looked like the Kansas City Chiefs. They would have looked just like the Kansas City Chiefs.
Really?
Did last
they
night.
Would. They would. And I think that would have helped them entering the first game of the wild card. Obviously, it would have given them loads more confidence than I think that, you know, a team in another situation, you know, struggling to get in or barely getting in on top, than that team would, let's say, confidence-wise. So I think the game in and of itself was disappointing because, again, the Jets did get outplayed, and it was not a game in which the Jets, again, deserved to necessarily win because I did not think they were the better team. But in hindsight, I feel like this is a game that if you play it, Haas, 10 times, the Jets should be able to win 9 out of 10 times. I just think that this one time, when you notice the differences, the mistakes that were made, those mistakes and differences are tweaked. Or perhaps, as you mentioned, the coverages are changed. Perhaps it's just the matchups in general are just shifted. You know, it could be a different outcome. But you know, when you look back at it, I guess now it's time for the New York Jets to start, you know, looking at some of the areas that they can take from games like this, that they can mm-hmm. take from games earlier in the season and build up on moving forward, so that next year, you know, you won't be in the same situation where you're forced to win in your last game of the season.
Exactly, and even though they did have a pretty good season, come on, 7-6, they beat our expectations, Amiri. I thought they were going to get 7 wins. I believe you went near 8 or 9, so, I mean, you were definitely closer than I was. I mean, not a lot was expected of this team, you know, putting it together with Marshall just joining and then trying to see what's going to happen at the quarterback position, especially with what happened early in the season, Geno down, Fitzpatrick up. But, you know, you didn't expect a season like this. But when you're in a season like this, you expect to take it and run with it. And the Jets had been winning during that streak, Amiri. The Jets had been winning games they had no business winning. They weren't the best team on the field some of those games, and they were coming out on top. I mean, if Dallas had anywhere near a quarterback, it's that game. There's a lot of games we can go back to and kind of nitpick at and see where the Jets could have and possibly should have gone better. And, you know, playing those games that way, getting away with not playing your best and winning, that could also have been what led to a 22-17 loss to the Buffalo Bills. Here's a team who, in the beginning of the season, and what got them off to an early start, Amiri, was the run game. How did they lose the run game in their last game of the season? Ivory 6-for-81. Okay, one shot for 50 yards, and the Jets don't score on that drive. Okay, Ridley gets the ball. He runs 9-for-79. Those are great running numbers. Okay, they needed to go up. You needed to see more attempts from the backs out of the backfield. Give Shetty a little bit more time. Okay, and get, you know, take a little bit more off of his shoulders. You know, a guy who knows that this is going to be his first attempt to make the playoffs. You know how he's going to be amped up. He's going to want to do too much. He's going to want to do everything. Brandon Marshall, another player, it was going to be his first time in the postseason. He was going to do too much. You had a running game that, for the first time in a while, was really working. They should have gone to it more. That's just my perspective. Green and White Show, you can always catch our perspectives here. Amiri Tillich there, Joseph Haas here. Don't forget, you can always get our perspectives on Twitter 24/7. Follow him on Twitter at Amiri Tillich. You can follow me on Twitter at Jersey Haas. Amiri, here's one stat I heard during the week that I couldn't believe. The Jets had won 10 games, but 7 of the 10 teams they beat had double-digit losses. I heard that from Tony Page on WFAN. Are you kidding me? So you're trying to tell me 7 out of the 10 teams that the Jets beat this year weren't even worth it. Hey, guess what? One was the Patriots when they were in their slide. So that's just 2 games, okay? So maybe we were maybe the wool was being pulled over our eyes, okay, by this New York right. Jets team. And Mary, your thoughts on if the Jets were really as good as they said they were? We heard that once before.
Let's just go through their schedule, I guess, now that I think about it. You know, you think the first 2 games when the Jets got off to that 2-0 start, remember the Colts started – like 0-3, 0-4. So the Colts, by that point in the season, were out of the conversation. Jets, you know, beat them handily. Obviously, the Browns are the Browns. Where they are right now is the same. The Dolphins, they had 10 losses on the year. They're certainly not a conversation starter. The Redskins, I think, might be the only team that was there. Did the Redskins make it above 500, or did they just sneak in?
They are. Of course, they finished the season 9-7, winning the NFC.
9-7. Okay. There you go.
Yeah, so but I mean, think about it. At the time, the Washington Redskins weren't considered anything. They were like the Jets came out of nowhere this year. The Washington Redskins, in the beginning of the season, weren't considered. I mean, they were pricked by most prognosticators around then to finish near the bottom of the NFC East, if not in the cellar. Okay, so they're a surprise team to win the NFC East. So, getting a win against them earlier in the season wasn't even as big a deal as looking back at the schedule now.
Right. Then they sneak by the Jaguars in that overtime game. Jaguars are no team to write home about. The Dolphins, again, they beat the Giants. We know what happened to them a little later on in the year. That was around the time. I feel like that was around the time when the Giants were just starting to head into that end of season, decline. But that was during the Jets, 5-game win streak. They beat the Titans, again, another team that's questionable. Beat the Cowboys, another team that's questionable. And then that last Patriots victory, as you just mentioned there, but. You know, if you really go back and identify the teams that they played and where they were in their respective seasons, it does kind of devalue, I guess, if that makes any sense, devalue the victories that the Jets got. I still think the wins are valid, but I don't know if it comes at the same, the same price or the same heft now, considering what we now know, I guess, about the season and its overall perspective.
Yeah, I mean, what you're finding out now is, hey, you know, was this really the big, bad New York Jets we thought they were? We were on the magic carpet ride as well. A win is a win in this NFL, but they're not going to be able to take advantage of teams as easily as they did last season. Number one, they're not going to sneak up on anybody. All right. Number two, they're not going to be playing teams like the lowly NFC East, which was decrepit this year. They just played the 2 worst divisions in football this season. The NFC East and the AFC South. You know what they're not going to do? Play the worst 2 divisions in football next season, okay? They're going to be playing teams like, I mean, they've got Arizona and the NFC West on their card, okay? They're also going to be playing teams like Pittsburgh, which you can already see is a team with so many weapons. There's going to be there's going to be tougher teams on the schedule. They're going to go and have to play Kansas City, all right? So it's going to be a lot tougher for this New York Jets team. It's not going to be the cakewalk it was this season. And to only get to 10 wins and to not make the postseason push, to watch the games last night, Amiri, you knew this was the Jets' moment. And they let opportunity pass them by.
Exactly. I certainly think so. And, you know, I think a lot of conversation should be had about what the Jets might have done in the postseason if they had snuck in. And I think that's all a meaningful, interesting conversation. But at this point, Haas, I mean, if they would have won against the Bills, they would have been on a 6-game win streak. And imagine the conversation at that point, right? Like, I think what the conversation would have been, as we kind of touched on a little bit earlier, is here come those Jets. And if you're, let's say, Kansas City or Pittsburgh or Cincinnati or, you know, any of the teams that are in the wild card mix right now, would you want to play the New York Jets your first game?
Not at all. None of those division winners would have wanted to play the New York Jets. Just like, well, they weren't even able to take on the opponents they did have. So the Jets were one of those teams, just like the Chiefs, just like the Steelers, who, you know, going into a road situation, would have probably been favored against those teams for as good as they've been playing and for how they held up. So and I know I can't wait to get into these games from last night. look, the Jets have a lot of work to do. It's not a quick fix. You know, tweeting with Chris Lopresti yesterday as well, as he was going over some of the things that the New York Jets needed to do in terms of building. Yeah, GM McCagney, you know what? It was good. You did a good job last season, but now here's where the real work begins. Okay, you definitely need to shore up the offensive line. That's no question. There needs to be an addition there in terms of who you building towards for the future there. Guys on the line right now getting a little older. Mangold making a Pro Bowl, but they're getting older, and you want to be able to keep this team a team that can both run and pass. You need agile young blockers there. Hey, the tight end position, Amaro getting back, Amiri, if he gets back, I'm just hoping he gets back, he brings his hands with him. If he's going to be able to catch the ball, that's great. That provides another, outlet for Fitzpatrick in terms of the quarterback. And hey, Fitzpatrick, is he the one coming back to play quarterback? Another question there. What are they going to do to solidify the run game? I say they need to draft maybe a third, fourth, fifth round running back. Somebody, a nice young set of legs. That's what this team was missing. There's a lot of holes, man. You go to the defensive side of the ball. Those guys are getting older, man. The middle linebacking position. Yep. You need a tackle-gobbling linebacker, like a Luke Kuechly, that kind of guy. Yeah. I mean, they don't just fall off a tree as Luke Kuechlys, but, even a poor man's Kuechly would be, there I put them in the same conversation, but like the Kiko Alonso type, always around the football. You're going to need to solidify the defensive back position. Revis Island isn't really an island anymore. I heard somebody joke and say maybe it's more like a peninsula, which is actually very funny. So you want to look that way. Cromartie, he's got a big cap number. Will he be back? And if he is back, that number's got to go down. And looking at his play, you're needing some support back there. Okay, the front line, of course, of the defense is great, but there are some issues there. Let's not forget special teams. An explosive special teams player is needed on this football team, Amiri. Somebody who's going to flip the field for the Jets and not make them have to force their way down 80 yards so much, okay? Thanks to turnovers, the Jets didn't have to do that as much this season. But you're not always going to get the turnovers. Remember, just last season, the Jets weren't one of the best teams at taking the ball away. This season, they were able to do that. So what's next season going to hold? You're going to want to have your own ability to flip the field. And that's what a good kick/punt return is going to be able to do for you. So, Amiri, just as we're putting a bow on the New York Jets season, we see that, changes. They're going to have to make some changes. They're going to have to grow as a football team, but it should be, and Jets fans should consider this, a good season. It's not, playoffs or bust. This was a good season for the New York. They won 4 games the year before.
Right, and I think that kind of ties in the expectations, too. I think there were some, I'd have to go back and listen to some of our preseason Green and White Show sauce to kind of get the true feeling about this season at the beginning, but I know there was some optimism, but it wasn't like the Jets were, again, as you mentioned, coming off of a medial season last year. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like the Jets and their fans were anticipating that the Jets would be kind of a wild card player, or that the Jets would be in the conversation of a postseason team, in the hunt, in the conversation at mm-hmm. in the AFC.
Well, to your credit, Amiri, you did. Uh-huh. There were many
I did give them. I did give them that benefit. Yes,
you thought that they were
10 wins.
Yeah, you thought they were going to do this. You actually said this is what the New York Jets were going to do. I was actually the one more poo-pooing and saying, hey, look, it's going to take a little time. It's going to be gradual.
Right.
Extra wins better than last year. But you were actually saying, hey, look, they're going to make a push. They're going to be that second team in the AFC. They're going to be there right around the wild card. And sure enough, that's exactly where they were. One more step in the right direction, and this team is in the postseason.
Right. And I guess that kind of changed the perception in hindsight. But I don't know if many people thought like the way that I kind of thought last year at that point.
No. You were definitely off on your own Revis Island right there. Which is what we go for that. Who wants to go with the herd? All right. I mean, you went out there and pat yourself on the back. But I'll do that for you. That was a great prediction. And sure enough, they got just as close as they could possibly get without getting into the postseason. And I know I want to get into some of this NFL postseason talk. Let's put a little bow on the New York Jets if we could. They'll be playing home next season. Of course, they're three division rivals. They'll be playing Seattle, St. Louis, Indianapolis, and Cincinnati all at home. On the road, the away games for the Jets next season. They'll be playing in Arizona, San Francisco, Kansas City, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, and the three division rivals. So we'll be talking a lot of Jets as they, do what they have to do in order to build the franchise up and get themselves ready for a powerful 2016. But, Amiri, we're going to get into a little ice time. Then we're going to have our guest, Reverend Ralph. And then while we talk to him, we got to get into these. We got to get into the games last night. I'm chomping at the bit here. I mean, I got so much to say about that Pittsburgh-Cincinnati game. But, you know, it might be raining outside, but you know what? The ice is always ready for a man, Amir. He's ready to put a little power shift. What's going on with the Islanders, man? I mean, come on.
Islanders. Yes, Haas. The Rangers are and the Islanders are kind of back in that fight. Islanders have struggled a little bit. Rangers are right around the same boat. They're both at 49 points right now. And at this point, they're fighting for the second seed because Washington is completely running away. They have the best point total, record-wise in the National Hockey League, 65 points on the season. Only 7 losses, Haas. That's just a ridiculous thing to think of with 41 games played. And considering how strenuous each hockey game is, that 7 loss stat in 41 games played really accentuates even more. So very positive start from the Washington Capitals. But yeah, now the battle is for second place in the Metropolitan Division. The Rangers and the Islanders both have 49. The Devils and Pittsburgh are a little bit below with 45 at this point. But, the Rangers are kind of making their resurgence, Haas. I remember, a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about the Rangers, we were discussing their kind of slide, from that far and away second/first, position in the Metropolitan Division to a lesser position, third, fourth. The Rangers are now making a push for the second place in that division. So we'll definitely see how that goes. The Islanders right up there as well in the conversation. But Haas, I wanted to touch on a team that has been just on a streak, and they have won their last 11 games, which is the Florida Panthers. And they currently lead the Atlantic division, and they've kind of overtaken Detroit and Montreal, really, who both over the past few weeks have otherwise held that first place position. But Florida has been ridiculously good. Again, 11 straight in as far as their victories are concerned. They only have 12 losses on the year. And the reason that I've mentioned that only is because you're coming from a division in the Atlantic division where there isn't much excellence, I guess, compared to the rest of the league. 54 points out of that division, crown is kind of pales into comparison from what's going on in the other side of the Eastern Conference and even what's going on in the Western Conference. So the Atlantic division isn't as well as the Pacific division, aren't the two strongest of divisions, but Florida has really taken it on, and their defensive efforts kind of are leading them at this point. They're first in the league now in goals against, only allowing 2.1 per game. And that has really been like the instigator, the push to behind their streak. So we'll see how long it lasts. A couple of the games went into shootout, so hasn't been easy. But this is certainly a streak that could continue. They've got Edmonton next, which is a winnable game. They've got Vancouver, who might pose a threat, but not necessarily, the most ferocious of competition. So this is a streak, a run that could potentially last a few more games here. So we'll definitely keep an eye out on that one. And then this is another streak that's going on. 6 games for the Chicago Blackhawks. They have won 6 games. So a couple of streaking teams right now in the National Hockey League. And that kind of is what the NHL is. I mean, we've both seen over the course of, a few years how teams will make runs and teams will, fall. And there are teams that are on streaks. There are teams that are for positive reasons, and there are teams that have won, or lost their last 6, like Buffalo, at the bottom of the Atlantic, division. So, it's a very fluid kind of season progression. So we'll certainly see if the scales shift as the year progresses for Florida and Chicago both.
Another strong, a powerful shift there. A couple of shots on goal as well for Amiri. A little ice time with Amiri, always fun on the Green and White Show. Remember, you can catch Amiri on JG Sports Talk as well. Always check his hockey opinions, football, and the rest there. Hey, let's get back to the NFL, Amiri, if we could. Take a couple of minutes before we get into our Ryan Fitzpatrick timeout to talk about what we ended our show with last week. The Tom Coughlin situation, if we can call it that now. Giants and Tom Coughlin parting ways. The media taking maybe a little bit more into this parting of ways. Is it amicable? It looks like Tom Coughlin's got himself an interview scheduled for Monday with the crosstown rival Philadelphia Eagles. So looks like the coaching bug is still still nipping at Tom Coughlin there. Who knows? Could you imagine Tom Coughlin on the sidelines of the Philadelphia Eagles? That would not look right. But you know what also didn't look right? Hey, how about watching Bill Parcells in a New England Patriots sideline or a New York Jets sideline? So come on, people around here, you've seen it before. Grow up, guys. We've all seen it before.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah, I'm just a little reluctant. I mean, I'm sure this is the same, as you just mentioned, same transition that fans had to make, you know, Giants fans specifically had to make years prior. It just never is easy, I guess. And that's the thing. It's never easy. And I know what do they call the farewell? Is it a farewell press conference that he held, where he shouted out Eli, you know, his going out, I guess. He was asked a question about, you know, whether or not he has his coaching hopes. And basically Tom didn't really answer straight, but he said, I have not completely, you know, shut down the idea of coaching in the future. But, you know, I this is not even just for me not wanting to see Coughlin in the Eagles uniform, but I just don't know if I can envision Tom Coughlin commanding a team.
Is it because of age or is it because you're just combination used to seeing him on the sidelines?
Of age and the fact that when you look at what kind of deteriorated him with the Giants, I think it was more of a talent and inspiration thing, and I think kind of got a little redundant over the years with the New York Giants. But I just don't know if he commands what a new team would need as far as if he commands the locker room, and he comes with a lot of credibility.
Look at us,
sure.
How about this? This was floating around last night as well. The Cincinnati Bengals, if they were to make a move with Marvin Lewis losing his seventh playoff game, still 0-7 in the postseason. Yes, he's been a long-time coach and a good coach. But if the Cincinnati Bengals were to make a move, that would be a perfect landing spot for a guy like Tom Coughlin, a team that doesn't need to rebuild, a team that doesn't need to reload, a team that, you know, quite frankly, just needs a swift kick in the ass. They look like they'd be going in the right direction. That seems to be the kind of fit that a Tom Coughlin would go into. I mean, I remember him back in his days when he was coming up and building the Jacksonville Jaguars. I remember those days. I remember the days when Tom Coughlin was on the sidelines of BC, so I remember those days as well. Tom Coughlin, a very, very, you know, a very good coach, had a reputation of being a very stern, a very rigid coach, a very woolsey coach. You know, later in his life, he's kind of acquiesced. He's kind of, you know, resigned himself to the fact that players are going to be who they are. And, you know, it's more of a working together between the coaching staff and the players. That's the kind of metamorphosis that you're looking for a guy like Chip Kelly, whose name is being thrown around some of these open coaching positions, such as the Browns, the 49ers. We all know the Miami Dolphins coaching situation. They've now hired Adam Gase, the former offensive coordinator from the Bears. So lots of moving, lots of musical chairs going on in coaching circles, as they usually are. Hey, guess what? hot coaching commodity, Hugh Jackson, offensive coordinator for the Bengals. He's now on the clock. On the clock for us, Ryan Fitzpatrick timeout, and here we go.
Yes, sir. House of listeners out there can go check me out throughout the week over at jgsportstalk.com, at jgsportstalk on Twitter as well. You can find me there and at Amiritulloch, AmiriTulloch.
Hey, they can find me up on hostileinterpretations.com under construction, getting back and better than ever pretty soon. In the meantime, 24/7 on Twitter at Jersey Hoss. My inbox is always your inbox, and thanks for filling up. JosephHossNFL@gmail.com as well. So back for more of the Green and White Show. He's Amiritulloch there. Joseph Hoss here. We're going to now dive, and I mean head first, okay, into these NFL playoffs. Okay, let's get the first game out of the way. All right, first, I put my predictions out there on Twitter for the games because we didn't have a show until today. So, of course, 2-0, pat myself on the back, yay. All four road teams are the favorites here in these four games. I don't think all four road teams are going to win, but last night, yesterday, it just seemed like it. I mean, Kansas City, number one, going into a Houston, Texas situation where the AFC South has been basically dreadful, okay? And the fact that the Texans were able to actually win that division with an above 500 record is only because they went on a 7-2 tear. And, of course, their back of their schedule loaded with games against their division. Okay, the Houston Texans, with their quarterbacking situation the way it was, I didn't give him much of a shot. And, of course, their quarterback didn't give him much of a shot either. Amir, your thoughts as you saw Hoyer lofting ball after ball in the air and it ended up being run back in the other direction.
I just want to touch on, I guess, the road aspect quickly. I think that really, I don't know the, like, it's always been a big question among sports, does home field advantage really matter? And I think it matters if the team is good, right? And if the team is able to get out and impose. And I think if you're in a position like the Kansas City game where you're being throttled and you're not scoring, then the home field advantage is obviously negated because there's no impetus for the fans to be inspired and involved in the game, right? When the Jets beat the Patriots at MetLife Stadium, I'm sure that the home field advantage was a benefit for Ryan Fitzpatrick on his drive down the field because they had the fan support. And I think in a situation like that where you can get the inspiration behind you, you can get and use the crowd's energy to use the crowd's fuel in a big situation, I think that can be a situation where home field advantage plays into it. But I also think in general with the postseason, I think a lot of the road teams that come in, they're in a position right now where crowd noise is the least of their concern, and their focus is just playing, and because they know that there's no alternative. So I think in the do or die situation, it might be a little bit more dire for the teams immediately to try and just block out all the distractions. And so I don't know if that's a factor. I think I'd have to talk to a player to kind of get a second up on that one. But I think from like my standpoint, I feel like in a playoff game where you know it's do or die, there you just won't care. Like, you'll just block it out. And I think that comes to kind of question whether or not the home field advantage really plays in, you know, to a postseason game.
Hey, let's talk to a guy who 8:30 every Sunday morning finds himself here and he calls us his home team. Hopefully he does. The Reverend Ralph Mancini coming to give us the rest report. You know what? Not a lot in AFC East news other than burying the Jets and the Patriots continuing on, but unbelievable games last night, and we'll get on to them. Reverend Ralph, what's up, man?
Hey, what's happening, guys? Yes, we are off to a rip-roaring start during this postseason play here. How's it going?
Hey, going great, man. We'll all try to be cordial. No hostilities, no hair pulling, none of that stuff. We're going to try to get through this without any personal foul penalties being thrown, anybody being thrown out here, any coaches. What the heck went on in that second game? Ralph, talk to me. I mean, it went from NFL to WWE, and I swear I saw some UFC going on out there. You tell me.
You know, it wasn't just in the fourth quarter. As you mentioned, I mean, we saw incidents there take place in the first quarter all the way through the fourth quarter. There was that one play with Mike Munchak and Reggie Nelson along the sidelines. And Vontaze Burfict was just, I mean, he played a pretty good game, actually. But, you know, the way he comported himself was just disgraceful. Just played a part of the bully from start to finish. And, you know, I have to say, you know, a lot of people now after the fact are pointing fingers at Marvin Lewis, saying, well, you know, what is he doing to keep his players in line, keep his players in check? And, you know, I mean, look, yeah, does he have some responsibility? Yes, he does. But what about the officiating? You know, I remember at the end of the game last night, Phil Sims, you know, of course, sticking up for the officiating, you know, being the company man and saying, well, let's not point fingers at the officials here. You know, they have nothing to do with this. Of course they do, Phil. Come on. I mean, look, John Perry, you know, he's the guy who let this game get out of control. I mean, at a certain point, you know, where was this guy? Where was the head referee? Why didn't he throw anybody out? You know, maybe if he does throw somebody out of the game, you know, these guys at the end, they would have enough sense, you know, not to complain, not to, you know, hit people with cheap shots, I should say. You know, and so, you know, at a certain point, why doesn't this referee stop the game, call both head coaches to the middle of the field, and tell them, hey, listen, if this stuff doesn't stop, I'm going to throw players out. I'm going to throw coaches out of the game. Oh, yeah, and by the way, you know, during that last penalty with Pac-Man Jones, what is the assistant coach doing on the field? You know, that shouldn't be happening either. So, yeah, can we point fingers?
Well, no. To defend that part of the situation, that coach was on the field helping to get Antonio Bryant, who was concussed and laid out on the field.
That's what you have a training staff for.
There's so many times when that happens, and Green and White Show, we're talking with Reverend Ralph Mancini and Maritilla Dad Joseph last year. There are so many times, Ralph, when that happens, that even the head coach comes all the way out to check on his injured player.
Antonio Bryant, one of the top players on the team, assistant coaches shouldn't be on the field.
But they are. This happens. I'm not gonna us all of a sudden point to the fact that what is this guy doing on the field? It happens in each and every game. We overlook that almost each and every time. The only time we actually pay attention is when it's the head coach who goes all the way out to the injury. But almost every time there's a training staff, and every once in a while you'll see the
training
position
staff.
Coach.
I bet the training
there.
Staff. Right, no, that's their job to check up on the health of players. But not
I'm
an
just
assistant
not gonna,
coach.
But look, I'm just not going to sit here and just go, oh, yeah, this never happened. Okay, this never happened. I've been close enough to the game, seen enough of it. Man, it happens in almost every level of football. Okay, this instance in particular, maybe that assistant coach had a little bit more of an edge to him. Okay, and plus of what had gone on between the two sidelines, yeah, maybe that you take into consideration with an assistant coach out there and him probably not supposed to be going back and forth and having more comportment with himself, to have more comportment and not go, yeah, you expect that from an assistant coach. But for me to say, and for us to get away with saying, what the heck is an assistant coach doing out there, that can't happen because it happens all the time in the game.
Well, you know, look, we can argue on that, but mm-hmm. I think that game just spiraled out of control. And that's
yes.
also because I think the officials and the head referee, John Parry, I think he failed to take control of this game. And at a certain
Agreed.
Point, it was total chaos out there. So, yeah, you know what? Everybody was crucifying Marvin Lewis. And it wasn't just his fault. You know, it wasn't just his fault. Let's not just pile everything on him.
Well, I agree that the overall theme, I guess, is in hindsight is that, you know, this could have been avoided or minimized if, you know, the head referee had taken control or the referee crew in general had taken control a little bit earlier. Now, I just want to ask, you know, as far as the actual game is concerned, do you think, would Pittsburgh, or let me put it this way. Pittsburgh was able to prevail at the end, but largely because of those penalties. Would the conversation have been as relevant about the Bengals and the injustices? Okay, so let's say those personal fouls were not called, the Steelers lose, but the Bengals had still done what they had done. Would the Bengals have been as crucified in a victory as I think they are now? Because the Steelers contributed, but they aren't receiving half as much I guess, comments about what they did or what they didn't do. So I don't know if I'm asking the question correctly, but like the way that people are receiving the Steelers in the aftermath is they aren't viewed as saints now, but they aren't getting as much crucification as the Bengals are right now. Would that have changed if the scores, let's say, or the teams were reversed, if that makes sense?
Well, if Cincinnati would have ended up winning this game, I don't think Pittsburgh would have been as criticized as the Bengals are right now, just because those penalties that were committed by those two Bengals players cost their team the game. You know, as far as Cincinnati goes, I mean, they shot themselves in the foot with those penalties. Oh, yeah, and by the way, let's not forget Jeremy Hill's fumble that had something to do with it, too. But no, if the Bengals hold on and win the game, I don't think the Steelers are facing the same type of scrutiny that the Bengals faced after the game last night.
I wanted to jump in and answer that question as well, and agree a lot with what Ralph has just said. The Bengals were the ones out there acting a little bit more like complete idiots than the Steelers were, and it actually looked a lot more overtly. As you can tell, Coach Tomlin was doing everything he can to show that he had command and control over his sideline.
Right.
Where it didn't look so much where Marvin Lewis seemed to be just kind of letting things go as he normally would. Coach Tomlin seemed to be very demonstrative in showing the fact that, hey, look, I got control over what's going on over here, actually. I can actually remember him, you know, physically restraining his sideline as officials are having conversations within a few feet of him. So in terms of just the optic, that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it, guys, is let's call this game for what it was. All right? If it's not for Big Ben getting injured, this game was in no way, shape, or form anywhere near the Bengals having a response in this game. They were getting thwarted by a team that should have been up 30-0. Instead, they were only up 15-0 because of their ineptitude in scoring, okay, because they're missing one half of their offense in terms of the running game, which was still a pretty good running game. But this game was actually pretty much no contest for three quarters, all right? Big Ben gets hurt. Landry Jones comes in. The Steelers' offense now has no run game and no quarterback, all right? So a few three and out. Bengals get a little hype. They get a score, and now you got yourself a football game. But until Big Ben goes down, we're not even talking about a football game. We could be sitting here talking about two blowouts and the Bengals really losing their minds on the sidelines. Agree or disagree, guys?
Well, you know what was sad about the game is that Vontaze Burfict could have been the hero of this game.
Yeah.
I mean, he came up with two game-changing plays. Not only did he knock Big Ben out of the game, okay,
mm-hmm.
Causing him to land on his shoulder, but
mm-hmm.
then he comes up with a huge interception also at the end of the contest. And so, you know, I mean, off of Landry Jones. So, but you know, he went from hero to GOAT, like, almost within an instant.
Now, this is a question Haas and I had posed earlier, considering the whole conversation around his exit with the Giants and his future. But with Tom Coughlin in that situation, let's say he was the head coach of that team, could the Bengals use Tom Coughlin as an enforcer?
Tom Coughlin, maybe about, 10, 12 years ago, I think
agreed.
He was more of an old school, type of disciplinarian, kind of like in the mold of a Bill Parcells. But I think he's changed in the past few years. I think he's had to change, just to deal with guys like initially, Michael Strahan, he wasn't seeing eye to eye with Coughlin, back a few years ago. So I don't think that Coughlin is that same type of coach. I think he's had a change, and I think he did change. Is he more of a disciplinarian than Marvin Lewis? Yeah, I would say so, probably, but not to the point where, he's going to be this big intimidating presence that's going to, really keep his players in line.
I know I wanted to add a little bit to my answer from before, Mary, and I know I said that Tom Coughlin would be a perfect fit for a job like the Cincinnati job. In terms of, what would need to be accomplished in order to get that team to go over the hump. Now, in terms of them, in terms of discipline, or for instance, I mean, he had his own instance right here in New York as we watched him in the Odell Beckham Jr. situation. And that, according to many and, to all observers, should have been handled a little bit better. Now you go from having one guy who acts like that to a few guys who act like that on the Bengals. I'm not looking for coaches to come out here and be babysitters or anything like that. These are grown men. They're supposed to be able to at least handle their emotions. They've been going through this pretty much their entire lives, from peewee football to high school football to college football. You're going through some of the same emotions. Sure, I know at the biggest, and it's actually penultimate level here, you're looking at, okay, one game you win, you continue. One game you lose, and your season's over. Everything rides on this. I get that, but still, the ability to act like grown men and athletes, that shouldn't be lost on me.
How's a head coach going to stop Vontaze Burfict for coming in late and hitting Antonio Brown at the end of the game with what I think was a cheap shot at the end of the game? How is a coach supposed to stop that, something that happens on the field, during the play? How is a coach supposed to stop that?
If you want to know how a coach is supposed to stop that, it's with the overall philosophy and mentality of the team. You start that from the first day you walk preseason on what your football team is going to be. Are we going to be out there on the football field playing like thugs, or are we going to be out there on the football field playing like athletes and showing the athlete across from us a common respect? Okay, that's a difference there. Now, maybe Marvin Lewis isn't putting his foot down like he should in terms
of,
you know, getting these guys in line.
Well, I think the problem is drafting a lot of these players, bringing these players in with these histories, you know. Guys like Pac-Man Jones and Vontaze Burfict, you know. I mean, these guys can't, you know, these guys were choir boys when they were brought in. I think, you know, we all knew what their histories were.
Okay, but yes, no players are going to be perfect in terms of comportment or attitude. I mean, some are going to have checkered past, some aren't, okay? You got NFL players who go through, you know, their college career, they come into the NFL and then something happens. Well, you can't expect the coach to kind of rein each person in.
You know, if you get one or two of them, it's one thing, but if you put too many of these guys together on one team, then, yeah, you know, I think they
just
spiral out of
control.
Yeah, but then
I don't want to get into labeling young athletes as well. Remember, they're all youngsters. People have made mistakes at a young point in their life, and they're able to overcome them. So I'm not going to give them a black eye.
Pac-Man Jones is not that young.
Well, no, I'm talking about some of his initial. I don't want to sit here and say here's a guy who's got a tremendous upside in the future as long as he can keep his head on straight. I'm not going to not give him that opportunity because he made a couple of transgressions or was on the wrong side of the law once or twice as a college student or a high school student. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and see if around other grown men this man can grow. Okay, so, you know, we've been around Pac-Man Jones for a while. He is who he is. We all saw him on Instagram yesterday. He is who he is, okay? He went with a little tirade, and then he came back and, you know, put up an apology as well, all right? You know, but it's all about the ability to control emotions. I heard some people coming on the radio talking about, you know what, the athletes, professional athletes, football players should all be in mandatory anger management programs. Is that what we want to do? Because there's some football players, there are a lot of players out there that can handle themselves, go out there, have themselves 4 hours of unbelievable football play, then go home and pick up their daughter and not have a problem. So you know, it is for some, it is for others. Remember, we're talking about a sport where these guys bang each other in the head on a repeated basis, and that's practice. I'm not even talking about the game. So we're not just talking about people who are, you know, these are people who we're talking about movies like concussions. We're talking about a disorder like CTE. We're talking about, you know, players who have to sometimes inject themselves or take as much pain pills as possible just to be able to get out of bed, you know. So
no, that's a great point. Let's not, you know, pretend that these guys have to follow the same rules as, you know, somebody, you know, working in an office building, because it doesn't work that way. You know, it takes a certain mentality, it takes a certain mindset for you to get on a field and to hit people for a living, you know, so they can't play by the same rules as everybody else in society. I agree with that.
Creator White Show, I'm Mary Tillich there, Joseph Foster being joined on the line by the great Reverend Ralph Mancini. Very impactful conversation about the NFL and more. Let's try to get the topic rolling a little bit here. We could definitely go back and forth on this one all day. Hey, look, let's bring it back to the Hall of Fame in the NFL for a minute here, because I saw someone with a comment about the NFL saying, you know, the NFL Hall of Fame compared to the Baseball Hall of Fame couldn't hold a candle to it. Well, the Baseball Hall of Fame made a couple of announcements. Ken Griffey Jr. and Mike Piazza both very dear to my heart. Ken Griffey Jr., like that's my guy. But the NFL cut their list down to the finalists, okay? Morton Anderson, Steve Atwater, a couple of the finalists. Alan Faneca, Jets know who he is. Brett Favre, Jets know who he is. Kevin Green, Marvin Harrison, Joe Jacoby, Edgerrin James, John Lynch, Terrell Owens, Orlando Pace, Kurt Warner. Okay, the senior committee have a couple in Ken Stabler, and then let's not forget contributor Eddie DeBartolo Jr. Now, there are some obviously names that fell off the list. Reverend Ralph, I want to get some thoughts on some of the guys that you heard me name, some of the guys who made it to finalists. Are there any of those finalists that are near and dear to your heart, or are there any of the finalists that you heard their names and went, ah, that guy shouldn't be on there?
In football, wow, there are just so many players and contributors out there that, you know, don't make it every year that are deserving of induction. Some of the names that stuck out to me, I mean, obviously Brett Favre, I think, should be a shoo-in. I think another person that people don't talk nearly enough about is Marvin Harrison. I mean, after a few years, have we forgotten the types of numbers that this guy put up each and every year? Yeah, I know he was catching passes from Peyton Manning, but this guy was just so consistent each and every year. He was a dominant receiver. It wasn't just a good receiver. He was a dominant receiver with the types of numbers and the amount of catches. And he was just a great route runner, very agile, very cerebral player. Yeah, he was kind of a mysterious guy off the field. I get that. But, you know, on the field, he was just a dominant presence at the wide receiver position. And then you mentioned Terrell Owens. Yeah, you know what? We all know his off-the-field antics. The guy was kind of a jerk a lot of times. But, again, was the guy dominant at one point of his NFL career? Yes, he was.
Mm-hmm.
So if we talk about overall dominance, Brett Favre, Marvin Harrison, Terrell Owens, I think all of those, every one of those guys, each one of those guys should be shoo-ins. I haven't had a chance to look at the entire list. But, you know, I wouldn't have a problem with Eddie DeBartolo Jr. making it in just because of his contribution, you know, as far as building the San Francisco 49ers and the type of dominant team they were throughout the 80s and 90s. I would say, you know, those three or four names really stood out to me.
So, okay. There were a couple of names that I didn't mention as well. Let's not forget Don Coryell, one of the guys who's made offenses the way we've seen him now. And let's not forget, of course, Tony Dungy as a coach as well. I threw out Ken Stabler out there Kenny Stabler. He's a guy who I thought should have been
Ago. I agree with Kenny Stabler. He's a guy that I think he was overlooked for many years. And it's unfortunate now that he's got a real shot to make it, you know, right after his, you know, basically a few months after his death. So it's a shame that, you know, he wasn't alive to see it if he does indeed get inducted. Don Coryell, he was a great coach in his own right. He was a pioneer with the types of schemes that he drew up, and he's really had an influence on the game. Tony Dungy, you know what, I don't know if I'm ready to put him in just yet. I think there are a lot of other players and contributors that I think I'd like to put in before him. But yeah, a lot of those other names I'm totally on board with.
Tony Dungy being nominated as a coach right now, but in terms of his value to the league, not just as a player, not just as a coach, but also as a contributor and mentor to young athletes as well. Tony Dungy wearing many hats for the NFL, which is probably why you'll see him get in. Amiri, I want to get your thoughts on some of these guys on this list. I mean, you know, from your eyes, seeing guys like a Kurt Warner even a little bit of an Edgerrin James' career, or if you could, you know, kind of espouse also on what you thought of Marvin Harrison as well.
Yeah, a lot of these names are a little ancient for me, which is probably
God.
Painful to you.
Please don't say that. I remember playing college.
Yeah, so I'm going to go through the names that I do know, which, as you mentioned, I definitely think Kurt Warner's in. I definitely think Terrell Owens gets in. I think his career has such a – obviously was gifted on the field, but his career took such a huge – he was such a character, and I think that character is something that the NFL will certainly try and hold on to it for as long as they can. Edgerrin James is somebody that I do remember actually from the Cardinals. I think he should be a very interesting mix into that conversation. I just realized there's a lot of Indianapolis Colts players and obviously the coach, Tony Dungy. From that time, yes. This was their dynasty.
All those boys have played with Peyton early.
Yep, this was their dynasty. And I certainly think Marvin Harrison gets in, I hope. Tony Dungy, as you mentioned, also just being the fact that he was one of the first, you know, really excellent and accomplished black coaches should be another reason why he's in that conversation. As you mentioned, the many hats that he wears, Haas. Terrell Davis should definitely get in that conversation as well as being somebody who's in. And so I think from the names that I recognize, there's certainly a lot of positive names. I think John Lynch is somebody who also is another, you know, viable option. So a lot of good names. But as you mentioned, Reverend Ralph, like it's so hard to kind of narrow down the list because there's all these, you know, legendary names, right? And they're filling – a small selection with such an overflow of great, and accomplished players, so, and coaches and owners. So some will go, and I'm sure there will be, you know, reasonings behind, others not being included, but there's never an easy, discussion to have to try and whittle down the list of greats, essentially.
Yeah, I think what we should really do, anyway, if I was a voter for the Hall of Fame, the thing that I think they should really make an effort in doing is, kind of separate, and I know it's easier said than done, but they got to find a way to separate the really great, dominant players from the very good players. It's unfortunate that we talk that way because, again, there are so many deserving names. But again, there are a lot of players, a lot of contributors, a lot of ex-head coaches out there, and we have to find a process by which, we could really, single out the truly great players and contributors, the dominant figures, from the ones who maybe just had very good careers.
Don LaGreca says this on his show from time to time, and I agree with what you're saying, and I think it puts great context into what you're saying. Within the Hall of Fame, there are many rooms, and then there's that room for only the special few, and then within that room, there's only so many. Within the Hall of Fame, there are many NFL players, and then within that Hall of Fame, there's that wing where these are the truly greats, the Joe Montanas, the Bart Starrs, they're the truly greatest of the greats. So I agree with you there. I'm going to throw some context into a couple of names that are going to be making, that are on this list as well from watching them. Kevin Green, okay, linebacker, defensive end. A lot of people are watching these guys. You're looking at the Khalil Macks of the world now. Before there was Khalil Mack, there was Kevin Green out there for the Steelers, and then moving over to the Carolina Panthers as well. The ferocious pass rusher, and he deserves his nod as well. Steve Atwater, before there was John Lynch out there doing what John Lynch is out there doing for the Denver Broncos, Steve Atwater was out there doing that. A heavy hitter who brought the wood and was also a great back as well. Morton Anderson as a kicker. Now, this guy made a lot of kicks. So, of course, what am I going to do? I'm going to remember him for the kick he missed. Minnesota Vikings, 15-1 football team. On their way, it looked like, to a Super Bowl. Randy Moss, I believe it was his first year, second year. Chris Carter on the team. Randall Cunningham on the team. I believe it was Randy Moss's first year. What an explosion onto the scene he was. 15-1 team. It looked like they were going to roll into the Super Bowl. Only one problem. They have a very short, makeable field goal in front of them. The guy hadn't missed, I believe that season he went the entire season without missing any kicks. The first kick he missed was the one that sent the Minnesota Vikings home that season. So Morton Anderson, a great kicker, someone who deserved to get a little bit of love on the show. Always getting love when he joins us on the show. The Reverend Ralph Mancini. Totally great conversation again. Make sure you come back and join us next week. All right, Rev?
Always thanks fun, again. Guys. Thank you.
Always fun. Thanks a lot, man. The Reverend Ralph Mancini, man. Make sure you join him on Twitter as well. Always a great conversation when he comes and he joins us on the show. We're going to dip into a quick Ryan Fitzpatrick timeout. We're going to come out of the break, top of the hour. We're going to get a great debate on for 2016, baby. I'm Amiri Gove.
Indeed, House of listeners out there, you can go check me out on Twitter at Amiri Tulloch, AmiriTulloch. You can also find me at JG Sports Talk as well.
They can find me at Jersey Haas on Twitter. Joseph Haas NFL is my inbox. Well, that's not just my inbox. That's your inbox. So fill it up, folks, as you can. We hit the top of the hour here at Green and White Show. As we do, guess what? It's just nothing but NFL. There's a lot of other sports to talk, so let's create debate. Let's get into a little NBA. I know, Amiri, we definitely have to get into a little bit of the NBA talk, all right? I mean, Steph Curry and the Golden State Warriors. I mean, what, two losses on the entire season? Are they going to make it to the All-Star break with only two losses? I mean, the 72-win record of the Chicago Bulls, that looks very much in jeopardy. And Steph Curry playing amazing. Your thoughts on my team?
Oh, my bad. Sorry, cut out for a brief second.
Oh, did my, about is my mic cutting out?
No, I think it was.
All right, a little more conversation on the NBA as we keep going. Okay, so Steph Curry, not just a great player, the great player that we're watching now. Draymond Green helping the Warriors as well. I mean, how many triple-doubles can one guy get? back with you and Mary. Klay Thompson, the Splash Brothers, Draymond Green, the Warriors. I mean, are we just gonna? I mean, we're just playing the season out, right? I mean, it's gonna be Golden State and Cleveland, right? I mean, that's basically it.
Right. Yeah. Golden State this year has really, and I think it's a combination of mm-hmm. of what he's been able to do, or what the team really has been able to do in drafting players that have really just grown with the team, and I think this is very. This might be a little bit of a stretch comparison, but as somebody who kind of saw the emergence, I guess, of San Antonio, I'm sure you can perhaps see the parallels of how San Antonio constructed their team and the way San Antonio played to how mm-hmm. this Golden State team is constructed and how Golden State plays, right? Drafting players, not focusing on free agency as much, prioritizing chemistry, prioritizing ball movement, and they're doing it with the new age, essentially. They're adjusting to what is required to score in today's new age, which is, hitting from downtown, being able to be varied, but also, being constructed with 3 points in mind. And so, that is very important to what this Golden State team is doing. And it's all headlined, I guess, by Steph Curry, who has really led this team, I think, to a level that perhaps nobody saw them to, achieving because of what he's doing, which in turn is something that I don't think anybody ever imagined Steph Curry would be able to accomplish, right? And I think now the question, should be who else is in the MVP conversation at this point? Because I think it's clearly been Steph Curry and then a drop between whoever the next name is. And so Steph Curry has run away with the conversation at this point, mm-hmm. at least, and his play is evidence of that. At this point, a lot of his games are just becoming highlight reels, play after play, possession after possession.
Now, in Michael Jordan's heyday, other players, and there were a lot of great stars in Michael Jordan's heyday. Okay, don't get me wrong. But just for there ever to be someone given the MVP trophy that wasn't Michael Jordan just seemed like, they were really trying hard. And, Karl Malone, I know, won it once. I think Charles Barkley actually won it once. But what these players had to do was to have a Michael Jordan-esque season for a season for them to be considered. Michael Jordan had Michael Jordan seasons throughout. And for LeBron James being, undoubtedly the best player of his era, for there to be a player like Shuley, in everybody's opinion, usurp him as the MVP is actually fun to watch, and I didn't think I was going to see. I just didn't think I was going to see. I thought I was going to see LeBron James be the most dominant player for his era until he's not anymore. But this is still in LeBron James's prime wheelhouse here, okay? There's no dick. He's still in his prime for another, 2, 3, 4 years. And here comes along this little wispy kid who, when you saw him playing for Davidson, the first thing you thought of was, well, this guy's got to put on 50 pounds. He's not going to be able to run up and down the court, much less get a shot off. And just look at him now and look how great he is. So I agree with you there with what you're saying in terms of what Steph Curry is, but also I wanted to bring that kind of comparison in that Jordan, through his era, there were some greats. There were some players who had moments of greatness, but never at the level of Michael Jordan's consistency of greatness. And to see LeBron James in his era of greatness, and have Steph Curry just come and just wow past him, which is it's just unbelievable to watch, and to watch the Warriors play ball. And to go back to your point about watching the Spurs get built, they're doing the exact same thing in the opposite way. What the Spurs did was they built and increased and focused on the front line and then built towards the backcourt, whereas it looks like the Warriors are building towards a strong front backcourt three and then, supplementing with the front court. So, awesome analogy there, Amiri, and great point as well. These Warriors are rolling, man.
Yes, they are. And I think at one point, at some point, I guess the comparisons will naturally come up as to where they align as far as the greatest team of all time for an individual season. I don't really know if I'm ready to have that conversation, Haas, but I just want to put it like this: in 37 games, they have only lost twice.
Yeah,
twice. It's just it doesn't add up. and I think that's what really makes their season so confounding. But I guess really quickly, just to take a little glance at the rest of the NBA, what Golden State is doing is really overshadowed the rest of the Western Conference. San Antonio is right behind them. Well, not necessarily right behind them. It's only six losses on the year. They're on a seven-game win streak right now. So San Antonio's very close in the conversation. The LA Clippers have gone on an eight-game win streak at this point, so they're another team to look out for. But Golden State is certainly not alone in their excellence in the West, but they have certainly, you know, taken a level above and beyond what the rest of the league is proving.
So true. What they're doing right now to the league is overshadowing. And you know what? I bet you the Spurs and Clippers are very fine with that. Let's just lay and wait until the NBA playoffs come around, and then and let's slaughter a couple of lower seeds and get ourselves to the second round. I can completely see them both going, okay, Golden State, you go ahead and you be the show. You be the show horse. We'll just sit here, and San Antonio Spurs not losing a game at home so far, you know? It just, you know, and I think that's probably the reason why Brian couldn't make it. And, of course, Brian, out there in Vegas, he's going to be joining us next week with a few stories. But I know Brian didn't want to make it because, you know, he saw that Knicks game. He saw how close the Knicks came to toppling the Spurs. He just couldn't muster it, you know?
Yeah, I'm going to take a couple
of shots at him while he's not on right now. Because I know he'll take a couple of shots when he gets on.
Yeah, it's but I just think in general, though, with the way this, you know, Golden State has been playing, it's kind of really epitomized what's been a very good NBA season. Although it's been heavily dominated on Golden State's efforts, I think just in general, there's been a lot of good moments throughout the season thus far, and there's you know, there've been a lot of good stories. Obviously, when you talk about what the different teams are doing, but just in general, the composition of the league, it's a very popular time right now for the NBA. And I think it's really one of the seasons that I've seen in the past where it's a very, as you mentioned, very monopolized focus on Golden State, on Cleveland, and the rest of the league is kind of just going along their business. But I think any reasonable NBA player, any reasonable franchise would be perfectly fine flying under the radar during the regular season and then just being a surprise, quote-unquote surprise, once the postseason begins. And I certainly think that's the aspect that a lot of teams are perhaps savoring at this point when they see the conversation being shown brightly on Golden State.
Well, here's how about I give you a little surprise in terms of local hoops. Kristaps Porzingis, KP. I mean, Phil Jackson's really got to be sitting back there wherever he is. I know he's not out here on the cold East Coast. He's probably somewhere surrounded by sand and palm trees. You go, Phil. You deserved it. Phil Jackson, already executive of the year. He could almost do no wrong this season. What a pick. Who was thinking that this was going to happen? And you know what? There's a lot of – I'm looking at box scores, and I'm watching the box score from the beginning of the season transition into the box score I saw the other night, where KP is clearly the dominant player on the New York Knicks. And I know it's only rumor, but I thought I saw a couple of trade rumors involving the New York Knicks. As long as they don't involve Melo or KP, I guess, you know, do what you got to do to bolster the team. But if there was a trade, which player do you think would be involved in the trade? Kristaps or Melo?
That's interesting. I think also really quickly, what's been kind of going back to the point of being overshadowed, I think Carmelo Anthony's been overshadowed a lot this year. He's not having a terrible year, but he's having a very solid season this year with the New York Knicks. I don't know. That's a good question. I think the Knicks always have that stigma of being a team that never builds for the future. So now that you have a young potential in Kristaps, I think he's the guy you would like to keep. But at the same token, Melo is the guaranteed sniper. You know what you got from Melo. You don't know if, you know, Kristaps will pan out to be this consistent, you know, forced in the paint. That's a tough question to answer. And I don't know if there's an easy way to kind of decide what trade you do. I guess whatever is given in return kind of determines that one. But I would like to see the Knicks proactive about the future, if that means keeping Kristaps over Melo.
There you go. See, I knew this wasn't an eeny, meeny, miny, mo situation. There had to be some thought put into that one. Yeah, I mean, you know, would it be out with the old and in with the new? Would 40 games of an NBA career usurp the many years that Melo has put in to this league as well? I love the fact that Melo, not too long ago, was near a triple-double, and the headline was Melo, 3 assists away from a triple-double. And I go, hey, guys, you're missing the real story. Carmelo Anthony passed it 7 times to other players who made baskets. That happened. You know, so we're watching Melo diversify the game a whole lot. He's actually come out and talked about trusting players around him more, and you know, more power to him for him to be able to, you know, pass up on some shots and for him doing that, the team getting better as well. So, you know, props to Melo growing up and you know, wishing him the very best and a good New York Knicks season there as well. So a little NBA talk. Hey, I wanted to get into something that happened early in the week. When I say early in the week, I mean Monday in the week. It's a little college hoops, but it's very rare that you get the number one and the number two team to play so early in the regular season for college basketball. So you get Kansas and Oklahoma, okay, 3 overtimes, 109, 106. You get the Jayhawks. The, you know, they've got some great players. You got Bryce Johnson over in UNC as UNC takes out Florida State. So you had some big-time college hoops getting started. And you know, it's about that time, okay? It's January. You know what happens next month? Next month about this time, we'll be looking at conference tournaments, things of that nature, and we'll be slowly getting ourselves into March Madness. So, I mean, is it too early to get for the Madness start? I mean, didn't you feel it? Like, I woke up and it was a little scratchy, itchy kind of thing. Is the Madness starting to creep over you there, Mary?
Very, very faintly here in the tri-state area. College basketball is not a priority, I guess, amongst the mainstream a sport fan, I guess, here in the local area. But yes, I am sure that once the conversation begins to reach a national level, I will have to jump on the college bandwagon again.
As I do every year. Okay, we don't want to force you, homie. We don't want to force you, homie. Yeah, I've never been there. Yeah, I know. In terms of mainstream sports, I've been one of the, and I got that probably from living in a bunch of different places. So, you know, out there living in California as well. Big college football fan, big college basketball fan, not real huge, but bigger than the area. Yeah, there's hardly ever any, you know, real talk about college sports around here. And, you know, it's just something that, you know, I've always been into. Loved going to the games, loved enjoying them as well. So, you know, I had to take a little turn around the college hoops. I'm going to get back to a couple of stories that, of course, should get some prominence this week. And that was the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame. Major League Baseball, man, has really kept himself in the conversation all year long. I mean, I feel like since the Mets lost the World Series, there hasn't been, you know, a couple of weeks that gone by where there hasn't been some headline. If it wasn't awards, if it wasn't a managerial change, if it wasn't something to do with players and now the Hall of Fame, baseball has really found a way to keep itself in the conversation throughout the entire off season. And, you know, if the game was just producing a more exciting, you know, product, they've got what you want in a sport. They've got that year-round, you know, bug about you. You know, they're on the bottom line. They're on the crawl. You see them on the back page even when they're not playing. So I mean, what's baseball missing, Amiri?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because, you know, I think the conversation is, I guess, would it be a multifaceted conversation? Because I don't know if it's just one, you know, one effect, I guess, that can be pinpointed as a reason. I think it might have to be, I think that might have to be a multifaceted one.
Okay.
Wow. That's interesting to, you know, to think of.
I mean, is it just the pace of the game? Is it that they're not
right?
They're not exciting, and it's not exciting enough or quick enough for what's going on with today's, you know, with today's young person, with today's, you know, more hip, more online. You think that content rules online? You're Major League Baseball. Guess what? You have 160 something games times 30 something teams. You got nothing but content. You know, and then you've got, you know, media markets to cover all of these teams. You would think in a content hungry culture that we're in now, the sport that would produce the most content would be able to, you know, outlast and have a year round, you know, impact sports wise. And also, you know, I mean, if this was football, just imagine football in the middle of the baseball season, talking about their Hall of Fame or this or that.
Right.
You know how amped everybody would be to just recall football and, oh yeah, and this and that. Like just me talking about, you know, a couple of stories about some of these Hall of Famers. You'd be going into that and talking about that and getting football back, and baseball's got it where they've got this year-round conversation. But when it comes to, you know, they're not America's pastime anymore. I don't care what anybody says.
No.
That was an old slogan. And whoever's not involved in watching some form of football, that's what it is now. You agree or disagree there?
I completely agree that, you know, football has really captured the minds and the hearts of America at this point. And the globe, essentially, right? The global focus of football is also a lot more expansive than baseball has really ever been. And now you see baseball trying to make a push to keep up on the international stage, because a lot of people, you know, across over the seas are being exposed to basketball and exposed to football, right? And so that's the exposure level right now.
I mean, yeah, these London games aren't a joke. I mean, they're putting two games in London every year, and you're going to start to see that, you know, creep up a little higher. We didn't get a chance to talk about the relocation application. I know we've made a mention here on the show, but the relocation applications to Los Angeles for the Chargers, the Rams, the Raiders. People are looking for, you know, these markets to get into. I mean, they're building a stadium in a place where there's no teams, you know, the places with teams are applying to move to these nice new stadiums. It's not going to be long before there's a team in London. It looks like it's going to happen. So the NFL is definitely, you know, reaching, spreading its wings a little bit there. And baseball, slowly but surely, isn't going to find a place in the mainstream. All right? And that's just, you know, that's just me, honestly speaking.
Right. Now, I wanted to quickly go back to what you mentioned about the Major League Baseball, what they could potentially need or what they're missing, I guess. I really do think that one of the reasons that the Baseball Hall of Fame is so conversation-inducing is that baseball is so rooted on its history. So when you get a chance to visit old legends, it kind of brings back what baseball's tradition is about as far as, you know, the history, right? And so when you get a chance to see, you know, former, you know, stars like Ken Griffey Jr. grace the stage, right, and give a presentation, I think that invokes a lot of the traditional aspects of Major League Baseball. What I'm concerned about, Hasu, in 10, 15 years, will there be as much of a interest in Baseball Hall of Famers?
You know, as long as as the steroid conversation continues and, you know, these guys are starting to get in, you start to see the ballot for next year. I already saw Ivan Rodriguez, Pudge Rodriguez's name on the ballot, so that's going to be an interesting conversation. You know what, Amiri? Anytime we have interesting conversation, you know, always just creeps in a little bit. You knew we couldn't go the week without getting a word in. Edgewise from our guy Brian Benway, reporting live from an airport near you. Brian Benway joining us on the program. Bigger, Badder Benway. How's it going there, buddy?
Gentlemen, I am at the Las Vegas International Airport. Good morning. It's very early here, by the way.
Oh, I spent a great night there one day. I definitely remember that. It was very comfy, very cozy. If I can remember the view looking right out, you can see the strip from the airport as well.
It's like 5 minutes away, yeah. But, you know, I didn't know if I was going to be able to make it on today. But since I love you guys and since I wanted to chat live in Vegas with a mimosa in my hand, by the way, I figured I would give you a call and see what's up.
Completely jealous. Our man on the road this time, coming back in from Vegas as well. Hey, props to you on the great laydown for Kansas City. Smart man, smart man. I hope you saw my post and went, yeah, that's a smart guy. I think I'm going to go with him.
I did, yeah. I won money on them, and I won money on Pittsburgh last night, too. So I went two for two.
Yeah.
So that's not bad.
Oh.
So I'm walking away, betting-wise, plus $600. Now, the other stuff that I gambled away, I probably am going to break even on the trip. But, yeah, I was pretty happy, you know, picking two road teams. And you know, like I've been telling my buddies from Houston, because you guys know I used to live in Houston, I was telling them all year long, the Texans are a terrible football team. They got really lucky that they're in a very bad division. That's why they made the playoffs. And as far as Pittsburgh goes, we all know that Cincinnati most of the time chokes in the postseason. And they did again last night. They choke on at home to the Steelers. That's usually what happens. If you're a Bengals fan, you know the joys, or the distraught, I should say, of your team choking in the postseason. That's sort of what we saw again last night.
Yeah, you know, Amiri, I said all year on this show, Amiri, about the Cincinnati Bengals and how I wasn't going to say anything about them until they won a playoff game, right? So I'm just going to continue to not say anything about them until they win a playoff game. So that's going to be my tact on them. But Brian, I know you got a chance to at least, you know, catch some of what transpired around the end of that Bengals Steelers game. It's been a hot topic on the show here as we've been talking green and white. Show me to look there, Joseph Foss here. Now, what are your thoughts on what you saw transpire at the end of the game? I mean, you know, the brouhaha, the fracas. Hey, there was an actual fumble. There was a game played last night. Let's not forget. But the way tempers flared, for lack of a better term.
Well, it's a playoff game, and I think you expect to have the intensity there. Now, what you don't expect is a bunch of grown men acting like a bunch of six-year-olds on the playground in second grade, punching and pushing and shoving each other, and that's what we saw. But they're bitter rivals. They're division rivals. They play each other multiple times every year. They know each other, and you want to go to the second round of the playoffs. So I get that, but you have to have cooler heads at some point. You have to say, listen, I know that we're in a playoff game, there are millions of people watching this thing, but as you guys well know, I've never played in a professional football game that I know of anyway. So I don't know, you know, how the emotions run high. I don't know. So I can't sit here and say that I would have been the cooler head if that were me in that position. I can't say that, but I think it's the heat of the moment. I'm okay with it. We've seen it happen in a lot of other sports. And, you know, let's face it, it's playoffs. You want to win. You're hot-tempered. You want to make sure that you're going to try and get a score late in the game. So I'm okay with it. It happens. It's sports. You know, and I think people that are going to complain and badmouth the teams, they don't get it. And when you look at what transpired, yeah, it's a playoff game. You want to win. Tempers are high. I'm okay with it. Let's rock and roll.
Hey, so many different opinions on that, Amiri. I mean, it's funny how we can get so many different opinions on the same. We all saw the same thing, you know what I mean? It's just funny how we can all get so many different opinions on it.
There you go. Yeah. I think the takeaway from this probably should be, though, that what the Bengals did really did kind of tarnish their look. Whether or not they were justified in whatever they do, whether or not they really did feel like, you know, they were targeted, let's say, by the Steelers, whether or not their claims hold up, I still think that the Bengals' actions took it to a level that made them look like the real jerks of the situation. And I think that they took it to a point where there's no excuse for their actions. And I think that's kind of my takeaway personally. I don't know. And at this point, I don't think you could really sit there and say, that Cincinnati's impact on this game was based on what Pittsburgh did, because what Cincinnati and what Burfict did and what Pac-Man Jones did took it to a point where you can't even you can't blame Pittsburgh for their instigation, perhaps.
But are you surprised, though, that it's Pac-Man Jones that did that? I mean, come on, guys. He's had a history of that. We've seen him do it time and time and time again. So that's his MO. That's what he does. We expect him to do dumb stuff like that. And guess what? He did it again.
Yeah. And as I tweeted last night as well, I mean, it took a while, but the Bengals, Tony, you know, they are who they were, and they are who we thought they were, and they finally showed their stripes. You know, they've been good all year.
Yes, any green quote. That's awesome.
Yeah, you know, I had to throw my buddy out there. You know, 49ers love Eddie DeBartolo Jr. getting making it as a finalist for the Hall of Fame. Had to get some 49er love out there, you know. You know what? A little bit earlier, and Amiri made me feel like the oldest man on the planet. As I was running through Hall of Fame names, and he was like, okay, all these old geezers. And I'm like, I watched all these guys play in college. So, real quickly, yeah. Hall of Fame guys. Let me see if I can get one out of you. Okay, so there's Kurt Warner, Orlando Pace, Terrell Owens, Edgerrin James, Joe Jacoby, even Morton Anderson. Okay, you got Alan Faneca, Brett Favre, Kevin Green, Marvin Harrison. Quickly, give me a thought on one of those guys.
number one, I don't think kickers should be in the Hall of Fame. And I know that's going to hurt your feelings. But, I mean, if there's anybody on that list that's a Hall of Famer, it's Brett Favre. It's a no-brainer. What he did, you know, the records he had, the touchdowns he had, the Super Bowl he won against the Patriots way back in the day when I think Amiri was probably, what, 4 years old back in the day when Brett Favre and the Packers won that Super Bowl. So I think if you look at anybody on that list, it's an obvious choice. When you look at Edgerrin James, he's not a Hall of Famer. He's on the list. There are a lot of these borderline guys, kind of like you guys were just talking about in Major League Baseball. There's a lot of borderline guys. But I think the takeaway from all the names that I've seen on the finalist list, I don't think anybody can disagree with Brett Favre on that list. But when you look at all the guys, there's going to be a couple, and they're always debated too. There's always going to be a Hall of Famer that gets in that maybe shouldn't, that maybe is on the brink. But I think the only guy on that list that stands out, obviously, yeah, you can call me Captain Obvious, is Brett Favre.
Well, yeah, in terms of Edgerrin James, and I know, Amir, you got to talk about him earlier. The one thing that I think hurt Edgerrin James in his nomination is that the guy right after him happened to be Marshall Faulk. Like,
right. Marshall Faulk did come in, yeah.
I mean, he was the guy after Edgerrin James became a Hall of Famer. So, you know, was it the system? Was it the guy? And did Marshall go out there and do it a lot better? That might actually hurt Edgerrin James and why he didn't perform as well. So,
Edgerrin James has Hall of Fame hair, though.
Oh. Well, how did I know you were going to comment on the hair there?
By the way, before we go real quick, I just won $25 in the slot machine here at the airport in Vegas, so my luck is continuing.
We're always lucky to have you on the program each and every Sunday, folks. Make sure you come on and join us. Check out Brian Fenway. So, hey, man, safe travels. Catch you next week, all right?
All right, guys, be safe. Have fun.
You got it. Enjoy. Brian Fenway probably going to win another $500 before he finally gets his butt on the plane. He's Amiri Tulik there. Make sure you follow him on Twitter at Amiri Tulik. I'm Joseph Haas here. Make sure you follow me on Twitter at Jersey Haas, as we always say. Hey, Amiri, an outstanding show. What do you think?
Yes, sir. Totally booked with topics, but fun as usual. Another great show, Haas.
I know, exactly, but you know what we do with these shows, right? Like, this is the end of another season. When the Jets season ends, we end the season and start a new one. And so this is going to be the beginning next week of the next season. I just hate when we have to close out these seasons so early. No one was prepared for – we were prepared to continue to keep going, right? I mean, I know I was. I was ready to keep this season going. But, alas, I say God bless. Go Jets. Turn it up.
Diversity Music Group. Alex H. The Bomb Factory.
Ladies and gentlemen, allow me to properly introduce the most incredible beast.
All right, we'll come back to the live
color.
Great show, my man.
To leather with soft butter. Color up, my dollars up. I'm winning exotic cars to women and more women. More sinning, I'm addicted to success. Black, young, and gifted. The bar's been lifting. Started from the bottom, I'm now on top of the world. Look, my, I made it. The new most hated. Underestimated since I haven't been painting. Our stories aren't related, so they don't believe. But who cares? I'ma run a few years before I fade to black. My impact shift back to order to lyrical manslaughter in the first degree. What the f*** is the ceiling? After my first million, I'm gunning.